Hello, fellow Kentuckians and other friends, and welcome to a new edition of My Old Kentucky Podcast. My name is Robert Connie, and joining me, as always, is Jasmine Smith. Jasmine, how are you today?
I'm doing well. Happy Valentine's Day, Robert.
Happy Valentine's Day to you too, Jasmine. We've got a good show today. We just wrapped talking to Kelly Smith, who is a candidate for Kentucky House in Madison County, Jackson County, and Laurel County. What's the number, Jasmine?
89th.
In the 89th House District. And that was a great conversation. I really liked it. Didn't you think it was good?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was an excellent conversation. But before we get to that, we have a couple of things to talk to you about. I'm going to be highlighting a couple of bills that are making their way through the legislature. And Jasmine is going to talk to us about tort reform part two. We've talked a lot about the tort reform attempts being made by the Kentucky legislature and Ralph Alvarado in the Kentucky Senate. And he is at it again, trying some new stuff. And Jasmine's going to tell us what's different this year because, you know, the bill got thrown out in committee. So Jasmine, go ahead and talk to us about tort reform.
All right. So in very early 2017, last January, we did an episode about torts and tort reform that you could go back and listen to, but a very quick recap. So torts are civil wrongs, so that includes negligence, which is medical malpractice, products liability, personal injury, all of those things are torts, any kind of civil wrong. And tort reform would involve changing the civil justice system to make it more difficult for plaintiffs to file tort suits, and it would put limits on their recovery. You know, why would we want to make it more difficult to file a lawsuit or limit recovery? Well, the supporters would say basically two things. Unlimited liability forces doctors to order unnecessary tests and procedures, and that eliminating such defensive medicine would actually reduce healthcare costs. And the second thing is that unlimited liability also prevents doctors and businesses from coming to our area.
Right.
So these reform bills have been championed by State Senator Ralph Alvarado, who is surprised he's a doctor.
Shocking, yes.
So obviously he has an interest in tort reform and speaks for all doctors on this issue. And we just talked to his Democratic opponent, Denise Gray, last week on the show. So that's Senator Ralph Alvarado. But opponents would say that this would likely increase medical errors and the level of care that's provided, which could then actually increase healthcare costs. And there's also the argument that, hey, juries work and people should be able to file a lawsuit if they've been wronged or injured. And also medical malpractice claims have actually been on the decline. So why do we need reform?
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of the two sides of the issue. When we first talked about this topic, we talked about two things that the General Assembly wanted to do. And the first one was creating medical review panels that would screen claims. They would have to pass through this review panel first before being able to file the lawsuit. And so this would make filing a claim a longer and much more difficult process. So that law passed last year. It was signed into law by the governor, but our most popular judge, Judge Shepard, strikes again. Judge Shepard sits in Franklin Circuit Court. He struck down the medical review panels law that was signed in the 2017 session. In his decision, he said that the effect of the medical review panel process is not the reduction of frivolous negligence claims, but rather the erection of barriers to the court system. So why is it unconstitutional? Well, the constitutional issue is that people have the right to a trial by jury, and this infringes on that right. And Matt Bevin says he is certain the law is constitutional and the government will be appealing.
So we have a bill that passed that got thrown out on one level, but they have a couple more levels before it fully gets thrown out.
Right.
Yeah.
So that case is, I don't know if appeal's been filed yet, but the government definitely intends to appeal it. So the second type of reform that we talked about was a damages cap, which I had said that would be on hold until this year because it would require a constitutional amendment. So we've been talking about a few bills that would require that. That means it's something that the voters will get to vote on in November. We currently do not have any kind of damages cap, but a lot of surrounding states do. And so that's why supporters of tort reform would say that, you know, we can't recruit doctors and professionals to come here because they'd rather go to surrounding states where there's a damages cap.
Right.
So we do have a damages cap bill this year. It's Senate Bill 2. And it's a proposed amendment to the Constitution of Kentucky to allow the General Assembly the power to limit damages for injuries resulting in death or for injuries to persons or property, and to provide a statute of limitations. So a statute of limitations would put a limit on the period in which you're able to bring a claim. So if they said the statute of limitations is 4 years, that means you can only file a lawsuit within 4 years since the injury. Mm-hmm. So the way that this would come up on the ballot will be just in a form of question to the voters. It would say, are you in favor of permitting the General Assembly to, one, place limits on the amount to be recovered for injuries resulting in death, two, place limits on the amount to be recovered for injuries to person or property, and three, create a statute of limitations or statute of repose as to how long after an incident a lawsuit may be commenced. So that's the question that you will be answering on your ballot if this bill gets passed.
Right.
So that's the damages cap bill. And then another tort reform bill that's also been sponsored by Alvarado is SB 20, which would require Med-Mal suits to have an affidavit of merit. It would cap attorney's fees. It would exempt peer review from discovery.
Whoa.
Right. That's pretty huge.
Yeah.
Right. It would regulate the copying of medical records. So it'd be more difficult to get medical records for these lawsuits. And it would keep the phrase, I'm sorry, from being used against a medical provider in court. So if someone at the hospital dies, medical provider comes out to console the family, say, I'm sorry, that can't be used against them in a trial, like as an admission of guilt,
right,
or anything like that. You know, that one's kind of a small thing, but these other things sound like a pretty big reduction in the rights of a plaintiff.
Right.
Exempting peer review from discovery sounds like one of the biggest things to me.
Uh-huh. Yeah. right. So, I mean, I know what this is, and you definitely know what this is.
Yeah, explain peer review a little bit.
Discovery is when documents or evidence is relevant to the case.
Right.
And
discovery is every bit of evidence that's relevant to the case.
Yeah, like and everybody can look at it who's a lawyer, right? So, like, if you're the plaintiff's lawyer or if you're the defense's lawyer, like, you all get the same stuff to look at and
yes.
see what's going on.
Peer review is the process that doctors go through.
Peer review is basically, like, if something happens or if something goes wrong, or not even if something goes wrong, if something goes right, if something unusual happens, if something is outside the realm of normal, so a doctor reacts to something that's happening, they can go to a different doctor and look at it, and that doctor can say, oh, here's what's going on, here's what I would have done in this situation, etc. And that's kind of an idea about how doctors learn and how they get better. And I guess, like, if I was Ralph Alvarado making a case for this, I would be like, you know, you're going to have these doctors who are so defensive that they're even unwilling to render a good peer review because they're afraid they're going to get their friend in trouble. So they're just like, no, you did everything perfectly, just so they don't get sued. But, you know, that is a huge reduction in plaintiff's rights for sure.
Right. And having to have an affidavit of merit is another hurdle that a plaintiff would have to get over to file a lawsuit. So this bill's had two readings in the Senate so far. I think a floor amendment has been proposed. Mm-hmm. So these are our new tort reform bills. And if SB 2 passes, you'll see that on the ballot in November. And then if it goes through, that'll be an amendment to the Constitution, and the legislature will be able to put damage limits on injuries, basically.
Right. So we talked a little bit earlier about Marcy's Law, another thing Jasmine talked about, and that also was a constitutional amendment. And there are several constitutional amendments that are winding their way through the legislature
right.
this year.
Only three can be on the ballot though.
Right. And I believe that that gets decided by the Secretary of State, I think.
ALG.
Which is Alison Lonergan Grimes. So if they pass more than three through the legislature, it falls to her to pick which ones they put on there. So I don't know. I don't know what would happen with this. But yeah, interesting stuff. I mean, this is big issues and things that are really important to lawyers and doctors. So there you go. Okay, Jasmine, I wanted to talk about a couple of bills. The first one I wanted to talk about was House Bill 227, and that is a bill sponsored by Republican Jim Gooch, who is of Owensboro. So we've talked about Jim Gooch in our show before. He used to be a Democrat, and he made national news about a decade ago when he, you know, as a Democrat, spoke passionately about his belief that global warming was a hoax. It was on national TV. It was huge.
That was a decade ago?
Yeah.
Oh, man.
I know, right? Yeah, it was. And it was very embarrassing as a Kentuckian. And, you know, I was and still remain like active in sustainability issues. And yeah, it was kind of ridiculous to be like, oh, the Democrats in Kentucky are so behind the times. They don't even believe in global warming. Now he's a Republican, which is, you know, probably
better for him.
Better for him, for sure. So he has his bill, House Bill 227. House Bill 227 would change Kentucky's net metering rules. So net metering is a process by which people who use solar panels in their house, they get paid back from utilities if they put more electricity on the grid than they take off the grid. So, like, you know, you're using electricity, but then you have these panels, and they can actually put electricity back onto the grid. And if you do that, that's called net metering. And if you do that, you get paid by the utility. So this bill actually doesn't go as far as Senate Bill 214 last year, which was a similar kind of bill, but it does make severe cuts to the net metering program. Just technically, if you're interested in that, you should read the bill. But just technically, the bill pays back at the price the consumer pays. So if you get your electric bill, it has, you know, this is how much you used, and here is the amount per kilowatt hour that we charge. That's the amount that you get paid back under this bill, as opposed to the cost to the utility, which is what you get paid back now. And utilities, they sell electricity at a loss at peak hours. So, you know, in the summertime, around the hottest part of the day, or in the wintertime, around the coldest part of the night. The electricity that you use that during that time is actually more expensive for the utility to produce. And you, under the current law, get paid at that rate. So you get paid more if you put electricity on the grid at important times. And that's the way that this bill would work. You would get paid much, much less than you would under the current rules. Okay, so this bill had testimony given at the end of January in the Natural Resources Committee, where Jim Gooch is the chair. And at the end of January, the committee did not take a vote, even though the bill was on the agenda. And whenever that happens, it's typically a signal that the chair of the committee is nervous that there aren't enough votes for a favorable report. So you have to have a majority of people on the committee vote for it to get a favorable report, and then to be put on the schedule to be voted on by the whole floor. But, you know, obviously, Jim Gooch was nervous that that wasn't going to happen. So, Jasmine, the next thing we knew after this bill didn't get voted on is that there were three more members on the House Natural Resources and Energy Committee, two Republicans from Western Kentucky and a Democrat from Eastern Kentucky. So House leadership, who runs the Committee on Committees, we've talked about the Committee on Committees, they said that Jim Gooch asked for more members because, and this is a quote from the Herald Leader, they had trouble meeting a quorum. And another quote, we don't have many members from West Kentucky. So bill couldn't pass with the people that were on the committee. All of a sudden, the next thing we knew, there were three more members.
So they just get to add committee members?
They're in charge. They can do. They make the rules. Yeah, so there
you
go.
So.
Yeah, and so the bill passed out of committee with 14 yeses and 4 noes, and 3 passes and 1 abstention. So, you know, passed with flying colors, but that was after it was pretty clear that it was going to pass. So people weren't really showing their hand about what they were going to do. On the day of the vote, Representative Kelly Flood gave an impassioned speech about solar energy in Kentucky, and that was great. I mean, I was really frustrated when I saw this was going on, but Kelly Flood's speech was, I was like, yeah, get him, Kelly Flood. other Republicans actually said that they voted yes in committee, even though they said they would actually vote no on the floor without an amendment to lower the haircut that would be taken by solar users. And one of the Republicans who said that was Representative Jim Duplessis, I think is his name. I actually don't ever know how to say that guy's name, but he's a Republican from E-Town. So, you know, there are some people that voted yes in committee, even though they said they would vote no on the floor without a floor amendment. So this was obviously a very controversial bill, even though it passed eventually with flying colors. So just on that topic, there are several floor amendments that have been filed to the bill since coming out of committee, but the bill has yet to be placed on the calendar for vote on the House floor. So we don't really actually know what's going on. But yeah, crazy story, because the House leadership just kind of packed the committee to get a bill through that Jim Gooch wanted. So, wah, wah. The whole science here is that solar panels, they have a payback period, and as you use them, you get paid more, your electricity bill goes down, and there's a little subsidy if you do it, and that helps to diversify the electricity spectrum in Kentucky, and this would certainly hurt that. So, okay, Jasmine, the other bill that I wanted to talk about was House Bill 98, which is a bipartisan bill about Louisville elections that's relevant to something we've talked about before. Several weeks ago, I guess months ago at this point, we talked about Louisville Councilman Dan Johnson. We talked about Dan Johnson's up and down the show, but this one we're talking about is the Louisville council person who was removed from his seat for sexual harassment issues. After he was removed, he was replaced by Vitalis Lashima, who is now representing that district. And the process for approving Councilman Lashima was eye-opening to some members of the legislature in Frankfort. So in Louisville, vacancies on the Metro Council are filled by the other members of the Metro Council. This happened several times in the past. Atticus Scott actually ended up in the Metro Council when Judy Green was removed for ethics violation, and then later on, Ms. Green's daughter, Jessica Green, defeated Atticus Scott in a primary for Metro Council in 2014. That will become relevant again later. So we've done this several times in the past, but basically what happens is several people from the district, they send in an application, and the other 25 members of the Metro Council, they look at them, and then they all vote. And you know, that is eye-opening to some people. Mackenzie Cantrell, who lives in that district that's now represented by Councilman Lashima, and Jason Nemus, who is he's a representative from East Louisville, both of whom are friends of the show. That's nice. They co-sponsored House Bill 98, which would charge the process by which Louisville replaces council people. Instead of the current status, you know, where the other Metro Council people select somebody, this bill would mandate a special election within 60 days. This was not without controversy. So Atticus Scott actually sits on the committee, which is the State and Local Government Committee, which heard the bill, and she voted against it. She was concerned about the a time that a special election would take and the fact that lesser-known candidates are at a disadvantage in special elections. You know, we decry, and Kelly Smith will talk about this later on in the show, about how we have low voter turnout a lot of the time in Kentucky elections, and special elections are especially bad about that. So you have an even smaller group of people that are making a decision about who sits in the legislature. She voted against that bill for those reasons, and some Republicans were very concerned with the cost. The fiscal note attached to the bill said a special election would cost about $40,000. But the bill didn't make it out of committee and was placed on the calendar. So we'll be tracking this one to see what happens. But yeah, that could be a big change. This is one of those things where I don't know how I feel.
Right. So Atticus Scott's reasoning is definitely the reason to be against this bill. I think it does hurt candidates who maybe don't have as much money or are lesser known in the community, and it does put them at a disadvantage and the issue with low turnout. But then again, it also seems odd that the Metro Council selects a replacement.
Yeah, and one crazy thing,
I don't know what the answer is.
One interesting thing about it too is, like, if the other 25 people are voting on it, then, like, the only people who don't get a say are the people of the district that's getting selected, you
right.
know, like, it's kind of crazy. It's like we're making this decision for the people who live there. You know, I'm generally in favor of elections, but yeah, I think that Atticus Scott raises some interesting points. Okay, Jasmine, we do have quick hits today. We've been missing them. Have you been missing the quick hits?
Kind of indifferent to them, but
Jasmine,
you know,
we love the quick hits. I don't care what you say. A research article in JAMA, the Journal of the American Medical Association, says that the largest cluster of black lung disease ever recorded is going on right now in eastern Kentucky. So that's bad. That's not good. Okay, so Governor Bevin is perhaps taking a break from the difficult work of working on a pension bill. You know,
you put a lot of question marks around taking a break.
Yeah, you know, because maybe he's taking a break. Who knows? It doesn't seem like much work is getting done. But he clearly found the time to file an amicus brief about the Hands-On Originals case in front of the Supreme Court of Kentucky. In case you forgot, the Lexington Human Rights Commission is suing the T-shirt company for discrimination because they refused to make T-shirts for a gay pride festival, gay rights festival. So, yeah, not working on a pension bill. But yes, filing an amicus brief about T-shirts. Last year, Jasmine, we talked about the governor and how he had an actuarial analysis about how much the GOP pension bill would impact the state and local worker pensions. And he refused to release this. So I just, if you remember, they had this cost analysis for the teacher's pension that they did release. There was a massive uproar. People got like super mad about it. And then they apparently had a second one that was about the state and local government workers. And after the big uproar about the teacher pensions, they decided to pull the whole bill. And then they never released the state and local workers one. And they were like, don't even worry about it. And people said, no, we still want to see it.
But we're worried about it. Yes. So if you could just show us.
Exactly. So, you know, Andy Beshear, the attorney general, he ruled that the Bevin administration violated the law when they refused to release it. So, you know, that's kind of crazy. Like the attorney general is out here saying you violated the law. That actually, though, doesn't really impact anything. There really probably won't be any fallout from this. And we will probably never see the analysis, which is why we decided to make this a quick hit and not an actual story. All right, Jasmine, are you ready to talk to Kelly Smith?
I am.
All right, let's listen to it now.
Kelly Smith is the Democratic candidate for the 89th House District, which covers part of Madison County, part of Laurel County, and then all of Jackson County. Ms. Smith works as a librarian at Eastern Kentucky University in Richmond, and is a community activist, including being active with the Madison County chapter of Kentuckians for the Commonwealth. She went to school in North Carolina and earned a graduate degree in library sciences from Simmons College. Kelly Smith, welcome to My Old Kentucky Podcast. So all of the—
Thank you for having me.
Of course. All of the other candidates we've spoken to have elections that are taking place in November. But in addition to a November election, you actually have a special election in 2 weeks. What has it been like to hit the ground running like this?
Well, campaigning for only 7 weeks in the middle of winter as a first-time candidate certainly has had its challenges. It's really hard to canvass door-to-door when the weather is like this.
Oh, yeah, also, I bet.
Yeah, yeah. My district is large, and there's no way for me to evacuate it in this amount of time. But luckily, like, I have a fantastic network in Madison County, and great folks in Jackson and Laurel County have been joining in our efforts. So my campaign is essentially being run by a small group of really dedicated volunteers, and they're all juggling work and family time, just like me, to help me out. And I'm so grateful that I am not facing a primary after this. This will give me time to focus on legislating if I get elected, or I can rest before getting ready to go in November, because this is really a sprint. For sure.
Well, it sounds like you've got some great people around you, so that's good. What is it like to do all this work for a special election and then turn around and have to do the same thing again 9 months later? Do you feel like it's good to kind of have a preview of how the district is feeling?
Yeah, I mean, it is kind of interesting since I've never run before. I will say I think that I'll get a much better feeling of it in the summer when I'm campaigning, and when I can go to, you know, barbecues and public events, and people are going to be out more. It's really hard right now to because people are, you know, hunkered down in the cold weather. So, I'm looking forward to the campaign for the fall, because I think I'll have more time to really talk with people before that.
All right, cool. So it's a highly publicized fact that several of the Democrats running for office this year are education professionals. So tell us a little bit about how your work has led you to your decision to run for office.
Sure. So unlike most of the other educator candidates whose experiences in P-12 education, my experience has been in higher education. And I cannot overstate enough the impact that budget cuts have had on universities in Kentucky over the past couple of decades. So to give you an example, 20 years ago, state allocations accounted for about 58% of EKU's budget. So of all the budget, there's tuition, and then there's private donations and other forms of income. But the state gave 68%. That figure is much smaller now. Mm-hmm. And if all of the cuts that are proposed by the governor were enacted, the amount of our budget coming from Frankfort next year would amount to about 10%.
Wow.
So my question, at what point does a public university stop being a public university and start being a private school funded by private donations and student tuition? And is that really what we want to have happen to our public schools that are supposed to be schools of opportunity? And then what happens to the increasing number of students who can't afford to attend public university without going to massive debt? That is just a huge problem.
Yeah.
And I think it's really short-term thinking The idea that the only solution to fixing budget problems is to cut the services. What that does is it's not long-term thinking. It sends the state backwards in the wrong direction. The CARA, the Kentucky Education Reform Act in the 90s, led to great improvements in our K-12 education because we started funding it more evenly, more equitably across the state. The cuts to public schools that are being proposed in Governor Bevin's budget are, frankly, just infuriating. And so I feel this is one of the main reasons I decided to run, because I'm just tired of education being attacked. And I think that legislators need to stop bowing to corporate interests and stop promoting the narrative that taxes and government are bad. We pay taxes to the government so they can fund the resources that our communities deserve, like education, and like healthcare and transportation and police. We don't pay taxes to drive corporate profits or build nest eggs for millionaires. And I think that's what's been happening too much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's kind of crazy. I graduated college in 2009, and the whole time I was in college, all that the school administrators talked about were the massive cuts to education in the state budget. And now whenever people talk about refund or funding higher education, they're like, if we could just get back to 2008 levels, and the whole
right.
time. Yeah. So it's like even before
even
all this.
Was low.
Yeah, exactly. If we could get back to 2005 levels, that'd be, just wild to talk about.
Exactly.
Right. So you've been endorsed by the KFTC New Power Pack. I think you're actually the only person who's been endorsed by that group so far, which is awesome. And you're active with KFTC. And for listeners who aren't familiar with KFTC, that's a progressive organization who's led the charge on issues like ending the broad form deed, stopping mountaintop removal coal mining, and restoring the voting rights of former felons for a really long time. They've been in existence, I think, since the late 70s. Yeah, and the organization actually started in Perry County, yet most of the elected officials who have championed this organization in Frankfort have come from, urban centers. I think of people who've been big champions of this group, like Kathy Stein or even, Mary Lou Marzian and such, who are, they're from Louisville and Lexington. What would it mean to have an active KFTC member from outside of one of those urban centers, in the legislature championing the organization?
Well, I'm not sure of the significance of me being a KFTC member from a non-urban area. It's harder to get candidates who are community activists because a lot of times we're poor. We don't have a lot of money.
Right, right, yeah.
We're working in the nonprofit fields or education. It's next to impossible for someone without a lot of money and connections to run for office. And that's one of the things that I think needs to change. So first of all, I think we need more people to run for office who have been active in community organizations like KFTC, or Rotary Club or whatever, local,
right.
Civic organizations, people that are trying to do good. So I'm tired of the idea of, I feel like a lot of people run for office for personal gain, and I don't think that that's the reason you should run for office. So the community organizing model, where local groups work together and collaborate to empower people in those communities to solve their problems in ways that work for them, I think that should be used in the government as well. I think my representatives need to be hearing from me and finding out what ways Frankfort is getting in our way when we're trying to do things, or what ways they can support us. So I am from a more rural area. Madison County is not completely rural, but the reason I'm able to run is I have a lot of privilege in my life that enables me to run for office. First of all, I'm still working. I work at EKU Library. And I have the role that I have at the library. It's more of a project-based job. I can work more hours during parts of the year and get big projects done. And I've got employers who are willing to consider letting me take leave without pay during the general session. So that's the only way that I can make this work, because when I was first approached about running for office, I said, I don't want to stop being a librarian. I don't want to be a politician. And people told me, you don't have to stop being a librarian. You can still work. And I was like, how does that work? So I started looking into it. And, it's complicated and it's really stressful, but I think it's worth it at this time for people to step up and do this kind of thing. The other thing that enables me to be able to run is my husband, who's a professor, he also has some flexibility in his job that allows him, because of his teaching schedule, there are other times when he can be taking care of our kids, while I'm busy campaigning or if I get elected. So, however, hopefully, my district is quite rural. All of Jackson County is very rural, and Laurel County. And I am still in the process of getting to know the folks in those areas and the organizations and the groups that are working to make things better. And so even though I'm from Madison County, I will represent the entire district. And I do hope to amplify the needs of rural communities when I'm elected. And I just want to give one example. So the first time I went to Jackson County and was talking to some people, the first thing that came up is transportation, because they have no easy way to get from I-75 or from London to McKee. And at one point, apparently there were plans to extend Highway 30 that would solve this problem, but that got dropped out of the road plan. And so that's a big question I have. And this happened recently in Berea. There was a big road project that was planned and it just got dropped out. And so I want to know, when I get to Frankfort, why does this kind of thing happen? What are we prioritizing in terms of road projects? And that sounds like a really simple thing, or like a pothole, like a easy thing to sort of pander to voters. But transportation, it's an economic justice issue. They can't have economic development in McKee if there's not an easy way to get there. It's beautiful. It could be like a tourist mecca, but they've got those challenges. So those are the kinds of issues that I want to be able to highlight once I get to Frankfort.
Awesome. Yeah, well, that's a really huge issue. We had a whole show.
We did a whole episode about roads and the road budget.
We consider ourselves pretty in tune with how, you know, politics and government work, but it was like uncovering a huge rock that was like, you know, this is where most of the money goes, and being abreast about how all this works is super important. And hearing a candidate say, you know, that's something they want to take seriously, that's like saying we're going to take our job seriously, and that's really good to hear. So that's awesome.
Yeah.
Okay, well, this race specifically in your district, it presents some pretty serious challenges to you. So your opponent in the race right now, Robert Goforth, the Republican, he loaned himself $100,000 for this election, and that is the largest single transaction that any person has made in the entirety of people running for office across the state this year. This district's only had a Democrat running in it even twice since 2008. It's been represented by a Republican for a really long time. And neither time since 2008 did the Democratic candidate break 40% of the vote. So, you know, given all of this, what are you doing differently than Democrats have done in the past in order to win this district?
Well, I'm not sure I can speak to that specifically, because I'm not sure what kind of campaign prior Democratic candidates in the district ran. I honestly don't remember seeing a lot of signs or really knowing what Democrats were going to be in the race.
So your first answer is trying?
Yes, exactly.
You're actually making an effort.
I'm making an effort. I will. I'm making an effort. And what I will say is I'm running a progressive grassroots campaign. So I think that there is way too much money in politics, and that's part of the problem. So I'm not attempting to match or outspend Mr. Goforth, but what I'm trying to do is be an authentic person, not talk down to people and listen to people and what they think. And that's hard for me, especially in a special election, because it's only 7 weeks. So if you have a lot of money, you can more easily get your word out there. So the kind of campaigning that I really want to do is going to take time. So I don't have that luxury. So we'll see how it goes in the special. I have gotten a lot of really positive feedback. And like I said, I have a lot of supporters, and I think the word of mouth is kind of getting out there. So I didn't have to pay for that word of mouth. I just had to, you know, talk to people. So.
Right.
Yeah.
So even if you do win, you get placed into a caucus that currently has 36 members out of 100. Democrats don't really have that much power, really not any at all. And so, you know, you've talked about all this effort you're putting in and, you know, all the personal sacrifices you're having to make. And, you spoke really poignantly about, you know, your husband taking care of your kids while you're out there. And I'm sure that's a very difficult thing to do. So what gives you the drive to work so hard to join this group, which, you know, really can't really even do that much?
Yeah. Well, I guess I just feel like in a democracy, the majority party is not supposed to be the only one with a voice. Mm-hmm. The minority party is also supposed to be able to raise their voice and represent the like-minded folks in their district. So that's number one. Number two is I hope the fact that I am running will inspire other progressives in my district to consider running in the future. There's a tendency in really red districts to either not even try or to sort of pander and run away from progressive issues. And I think that's basically a losing strategy. I think people can see right through that. So I think that as progressives, as Democrats, we have to make the case that our values standing up for social justice, equality, healthcare, environmental justice, economic justice, that these are the values of most of the people. And I think too often we get really bogged down in wedge issues and try to pit folks against each other. And I just think there's a better way if we want to move forward. Mm-hmm. So.
All right, so let's talk about some of those issues a little bit. This year, fiscal discussions have kind of dominated everything. The governor has presented a grave budget, which he says cannot be balanced without severe cuts. So pensions for teachers and retired teachers have been put on the chopping block all year, and the Republican majority in Frankfurt doesn't seem to have any appetite for additional revenue. So aside from the political realities that confront our state, tell us how you would approach the fiscal issues that we're facing.
Okay, well, first of all, we've got to find funding to pay for the services that we need to thrive. That is basically the cornerstone of my campaign. So the other day, I think it was yesterday, House Speaker Pro Tem, and I wrote this down so I'll get this quote right, David Osborne said, quote, "We are looking at aspects of tax reform, and some of those things may in fact raise revenues. But anything that raises revenues, as far as I'm concerned, is a tax increase. And there is very little appetite in our caucus for that." Mm-hmm. So he's saying that the Republicans aren't interested in raising revenues because that's the same thing as increasing taxes. And that is the kind of attitude I think that has prevailed for too long. So as far back as Ronald Reagan, there's been this narrative that's been pushed that taxes are bad, government is bad. And then what we really need to do is give tax breaks to rich people because that money will trickle down. Well, you know, it doesn't. Did you know that minimum wage peaked in the late 1960s, adjusted for inflation? So the late 1960s, minimum wage peaked. Mm-hmm. It's gone down since then. And we've been cutting taxes for the wealthy and cutting services for the rest of us. And that has not helped wages go up. It's not helped our economy grow. So I do not believe in that philosophy at all. Mm-hmm. I think further, in terms of raising revenue in the state, the wealthy and corporations in our state are getting a giant federal tax refund this year. Mm-hmm. So, you know, what if we were to take this opportunity to eliminate those tax loopholes that we give for luxury services and all those kinds of things? What if we took this opportunity to change those where it's not going to hurt them as much because they're getting this big tax refund? And how about we put some of that money into the services that we need as a state instead of letting our education system fall apart, instead of letting pensions default? So that's what I think we need to do.
Absolutely. Jasmine, can I ask this question?
Yeah, you can.
All right. So you've actually already kind of spoken to the need for additional revenue. You even said that that's like the cornerstone of your campaign, which is so cool. That's so great to hear. And anyways, I think I know the answer to this, but we've been asking everybody and we aren't about to stop now. Jasmine may want us to, but we are not. We're going to ask everybody this question. But for House Bill 29, it's a tax reform bill that's been sponsored by Jim Wayne, George Brown Jr., Tom Birch, Jeff Donahue, Kelly Flood, Derek Graham, Joni Jenkins, Mary Lou Marzian, Reggie Meeks, Daryl Owens, Ruth Ann Palumbo, and Attica Scott. Would you be willing, if you are, you know, you actually have the opportunity to add yourself as a sponsor to this bill if you are to win, mm-hmm, in a couple weeks, would you be willing to add your name as a sponsor to this bill?
Yes, absolutely. This is also a bill that's being supported by KFCC, incidentally.
Absolutely.
And on KFCC's website, it's called the Kentucky Forward Plan. If you go look there, listeners, you'll find a lot of really great information. But basically, so HB 29, it will modernize income and sales taxes. It will ask corporations to contribute equitably. It will allow us to reclaim lost estate tax revenue and institute a state-earned income tax credit to help the lowest income earners in our state. So I think this is a really responsible and fair approach to tax reform, and I would definitely co-sponsor it. This came out of the Blue Ribbon Commission, mm-hmm, from several years ago that I don't understand why none of these suggestions have ever been looked at. Like, you know, we do these studies and we get these recommendations and then nothing happens. So let's make it happen.
Yeah, Robert Stivers as president of the Senate is the answer to that question. But
yeah.
So, yeah, and, you know, we talked about fiscal issues really dominating the scene this year. But, you know, of course, those aren't all the issues. You talked about education being one of your passions. But, you know, talk to us about some of the other issues besides fiscal issues that you are really passionate about and that you hope to confront when you make it to Frankfurt.
Sure. Well, so So I believe in the public good and everything that encompasses. So services such as education, healthcare, social services, police and fire, county services, libraries, of course. Ooh, the libraries.
Yeah, libraries.
And so, like, all these things make our communities what they are. So if you think of any issues surrounding those, I will be working to help support those things. So in terms of, like, individual issues, there's another issue that I think we need to tackle in this state to help the process of getting good people in office, and that's voting rights expansion.
Mm-hmm.
So I looked up some figures to get ready for this podcast, and I was surprised that actually about 75% of Kentuckians are registered to vote, so that's pretty good. But so, for example, in 2015, when Governor Bevin was elected, only 30% of registered voters showed up at the polls. So what that means is actually only about 12% of the population of Kentucky voted for Governor Bevin.
Mm-hmm.
So 12% of our state made the decision that he would be governor. And I don't think that is a representative sample.
It certainly is
I
not.
Think we have to do better, mm-hmm. you know, get more people to the polls. And I think, you know, launching online voter registration was a great step. And I read that, like, voter registration is way up, but there's so many other things we need to do. Automatic registration. Extending the poll hours, even. There aren't many places where they close at 6 o'clock.
Kentucky has the worst poll hours of any state in the country. So, yeah,
yes.
That's a big problem.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yep. And simplifying the absentee voting process. You almost have to have, like, a doctor's note to be able to vote absentee. It's kind
uh-huh.
of crazy.
Right.
And then even just allowing early voting. Why, you know, what if you just want to go in and vote early? Why not?
Like, no excuse early voting? Because we do have early voting, but that's the thing you need in a doctor's note as well. And you actually have to
exactly.
have it when you go in there. But yeah, no excuse early voting
right.
is huge, yeah.
Or, and then here's another thing which would help us as a highly rural state is voting by mail.
Mm-hmm.
I have a friend from Oregon who said it was just great and it worked really well. And there's not, I mean, there's this like myth that you're going to have a lot of fake voters, but that's not what happened.
No.
So, I mean, that would be great.
Yeah.
And then and one other little big piece of this is that we need to pass legislation to restore the right to vote to people with past convictions who serve their time. Kentucky's felony disenfranchisement law is, like, one of the harshest in the nation.
Yeah, it's not good.
And there is actually bipartisan support for this, and we were kind of heading in this direction before Governor Bevin got elected.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that needs to get taken up again.
Absolutely. No, yeah, that's been a huge deal for a long time. And it really frustrates me personally that there are several Republicans that say that they're for it but won't champion it. And so getting some people
yeah.
that will hold their feet to the fire when they make it to Frankfurt is something that I think is a really huge deal. But yeah, those are all
yeah.
really, really good answers about things to be passionate about. And those are things that we're passionate about, too. So we're glad that you joined us today. Hope you have good luck in February and then again in November.
Thank you so much. It's
yeah.
great to be able to get the word out like this.
Absolutely. Jasmine, how can people get a hold of us?
They can find us on Twitter at @myoldkypod. We have a Facebook page you can like. Robert posts our show notes on Medium, and you can find our podcast on the podcasting app of your choice and subscribe to it.
All right. Thank you very much, guys, and we'll see you next week.